Jeg er nu Rath, Yggdrasils Heers Angreb, for I er Strudor, Ugras, og Skrund, I say, Abelia, Yggdrasils, nu er nu Aya, Zro.
Welcome to this, the 75th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. We have the usual lineup once again today, so let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, Part 39. 2 days before we ourselves started with our mule train, a train of pack oxen left, loaded with provisions, tools, and other things which we would not need until after a month or 6 weeks. We began our descent into the valley of the Amazon. There were about 70 oxen. Most of them were well broken, but there were about a score which were either not broken at all, or else very badly broken. These were loaded with much difficulty, and bucked like wild broncos. Again and again they scattered their loads over the corral, and over the first part of the road. The packmen, however, copper-coloured, black and dusky white, were not only masters of their art, but possessed tempers that could not be ruffled. When they showed severity, it was because severity was needed, and not because they were angry. They finally got all their long-horned beasts loaded, and started on the trail with them. On January 21st, we ourselves started with the mule train. Of course, as always in such a journey, there was some confusion before the men and the animals of the train settled down to the routine performance of the duty. In addition to the pack animals, we all had riding mules. The first day we journeyed about 12 miles, then, crossing the Sepotuba and camping beside it, below a series of falls, or rather rapids. The country was level. It was a great natural pasture, covered with a very open forest of low twisted trees, bearing a superficial likeness to the cross timbers of Texas and Oklahoma. It is as well fitted for stock raising as Oklahoma, and there is also much fine agricultural land, while the river will ultimately yield electric power. It is a fine country for settlement. The heat is great at noon, but the nights are not uncomfortable. We were supposed to be in the middle of the rainy season, but hitherto most of the days had been fine, varied with showers. The astonishing thing was the absence of mosquitoes. Insect pests that work by day can be stood, and especially by settlers, because they are far less serious foes in the clearings than in the woods. The mosquitoes and other night foes offer the really serious and unpleasant problem, because they break one's rest. Hitherto, during our travels up the Paraguay and its tributaries, in this level of marshy tropical region of western Brazil, we had practically not been bothered by mosquitoes at all. Out in the woods, they were at times a serious nuisance, and Cherry and Miller had been subjected to real torment by them during some of their special expeditions, but they were practically none on the ranches and in our camps in the open fields by the river, even when marshes were close by. I was puzzled and delighted by their absence. Settlers need not be deterred from coming to this region by fear of insect foes. This does not mean that there are not such foes. Outside of clearings and of the beaten tracks of travel, they teem. There are ticks, poisonous ants, wasps, of which some species are really serious menaces, biting fleas and gnats. I merely mean that unlike so many other tropical regions, this particular region is, from the standpoint of the settler and of the ordinary traveller, relatively free from insect pests, and a pleasant place of residence. The original explorer, and to an only less degree the hard-working field naturalist or big game hunter, have to face these pests, just as they have to face countless risks, hardships and difficulties. This is inherent in their several professions and avocations. Many regions in the United States, where life is now absolutely comfortable and easy-going, offered most formidable problems to the first explorers a century or two ago. We must not fall into the foolish error of thinking that the first explorers need not suffer terrible hardships, merely because the ordinary travellers and even the settlers who come after them do not have to endure such danger, privation, and wearing fatigue, although the first among the genuine settlers also have to undergo exceedingly trying experiences. The early explorers and adventurers make fairly well-beaten trails, but it is incumbent on them neither to boast of their own experiences nor to misjudge the efforts of the pioneers, because thanks to these very efforts their own lines fall in pleasant places. The ordinary traveller who never goes off the beaten route and who on this beaten route is carried by others, without himself doing anything or risking anything, does not need to show much more initiative and intelligence than an express package. He does nothing. Others do all the work, show all the forethought, take all the risk, and are entitled to all the credit. He and his valise are carried in practically the same fashion, and for each the achievement stands about the same. If this kind of traveller is a writer, he can, of course, do admirable work, work of the highest value, but the value comes because he is a writer and an observer, not because of any particular credit that attaches to him as a traveller. We all recognise this truth as far as highly civilised regions are concerned. When Bryce writes of the American Commonwealth, or Lowell of European legislative assemblies, our admiration is for the insight and thought of the observer, and we are not concerned with his travels. When a man travels across Arizona in a Pullman car, we do not think of him as having performed a feat bearing even the most remote resemblance to the feats of the first explorers of those waterless wastes. Whatever admiration we feel in connection with this trip is reserved for the traffic superintendent, engineer, fireman, and brakeman. But as regards the less-known continents, such as South America, we sometimes fail to remember these obvious truths. There yet remains plenty of exploring work to be done in South America, as hard, as dangerous, and almost as important as any that has already been done, work such as has recently been done or is now being done by men and women such as Haseman, Farabee, and Miss Snethledge. The collecting naturalists who go into the wilds and do first-class work encounter every kind of risk and undergo every kind of hardship and exertion. Explorers and naturalists of the right type have opened to them in South America a field of extraordinary attraction and difficulty. But to evacuate ruins that have already long been known, to visit out-of-the-way towns that date from colonial days, to traverse old, even if uncomfortable, routes of travel, or to ascend or descend highway rivers like the Amazon, the Paraguay, and the lower Orinoco, all of these exploits are well worth performing, but they in no sense represent exploration or adventure, and they do not entitle the performer, no matter how well he writes and no matter how much of real value he contributes to human knowledge, to compare himself in any way with the real wilderness wanderer, or to criticise the latter. Such a performance entails no hardship or difficulty worth heeding. Its value depends purely on observation, not on action. The man does little. He merely records what he sees. He is only the man of the beaten routes. The true wilderness wanderer, on the contrary, must be a man of action as well as of observation. He must have the heart and body to do and to endure no less than eye to see and brain to note and record. Let me make it clear that I am not deprecating the excellent work of so many of the men who have not gone off the beaten trails. I merely wish to make it plain that this excellent work must not be put in the class with that of the wilderness explorer. It is excellent work, nevertheless, and has its place, just as the work of the true explorer has its place. Both stand in sharpest contrast with the actions of those alleged explorers, among whom Mr. Savage Landor stands in unpleasant prominence. And now on to today's musical interlude. It's a track from 1930, and it's by either Wingy Minone or Wingy Minone. I'm not quite sure which. It's called Wailing Blues. Thank you. and finally for today on to the main feature, which is itself the final part of The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Chapter 5, Part 7. That Dr. Willett's purgation had been an ordeal almost as nerve-wracking in its way as his hideous wandering in the vanished crypt is shown by the fact that the elderly physician gave out completely as soon as he reached home that evening. For 3 days he rested constantly in his room, though servants later muttered something about having heard him after midnight on Wednesday, when the outer door softly opened and closed with phenomenal softness. Servants' imaginations, fortunately, are limited, else comment might have been excited by an item in Thursday's evening bulletin, which ran as follows. North End ghouls, again active. After a lull of 10 months since the dastardly vandalism in the Weedon lot at the North Burial Ground, a nocturnal prowler was glimpsed early this morning in the same cemetery by Robert Hart, the night watchman. Happening to glance for a moment from his shelter at about 2 a.m., Hart observed the glow of a lantern or pocket torch not far to the northwest, and upon opening the door detected the figure of a man with a trowel very plainly silhouetted against a nearby electric light. At once starting in pursuit, he saw the figure dart hurriedly towards the main entrance, gaining the street and losing himself among the shadows before approach or capture was possible. Like the first ghouls active during the past year, this intruder had done no real damage before detection. A vacant part of the ward lot showed signs of a little superficial digging, but nothing even nearly the size of a grave had been attempted, and no previous grave had been disturbed. Hart, who cannot describe the prowler, except as a small man, probably having a full beard, inclines to the view that all three of the digging incidents have a common source. But police from the second station think otherwise on account of the savage nature of the second incident, where an ancient coffin was removed and its headstone violently shattered. The first of the incidents in which it is thought that an attempt to bury something was frustrated occurred a year ago last March, and has been attributed to bootleggers seeking a cache. It is possible, says Sergeant Riley, that the third affair is of a similar nature. Officers at the second station are taking especial pains to capture the gang of miscreants responsible for these repeated outrages. All day Thursday, Dr. Willett rested as if recuperating from something past or nerving himself for something to come. In the evening he wrote a note to Mr. Ward, which was delivered the next morning and which caused the half-dazed parent to ponder long and deeply. Mr. Ward had not been able to go down to business since the shock of Monday, with its baffling reports and its sinister purgation, but he found something calming about the doctor's letters, in spite of the despair it seemed to promise and the fresh mysteries it seemed to evoke. 10. Barnes Street, Providence, R.I. April 12, 1928. Dear Theodore, I feel that I must have a word with you before doing what I am going to do tomorrow. It will conclude the terrible business we have been going through, for I feel that no spade is ever likely to reach that monstrous place we know of. But I'm afraid it won't set your mind at rest, unless I expressly assure you of how very conclusive it is. You have known me ever since you were a small boy, so I think you will not distrust me when I hint that some matters are best left undecided and unexplored. It is better that you attempt no further speculation as to Charles's case, and almost imperative that you tell his mother nothing more than she already suspects. When I call on you tomorrow, Charles will have escaped. That is all that need remain in anyone's mind. He was mad, and he escaped. You can tell his mother gently and gradually about the mad part when you stop sending the tight notes in his name. I advise you to join her in Atlantic City and take a rest yourself. God knows you need one after this shock, as I do myself. I am going south for a while to calm down and brace up. So don't ask me any questions when I call. It may be that something will go wrong, but I'll tell you if it does. I don't think it will. There will be nothing more to worry about, for Charles will be very, very safe. He is now safer than you dream. You need to hold no fears about Alan, or who or what he is. He forms as much a part of the past as Joseph Kirwan's picture. And when I ring your doorbell, you may feel certain that there is no such person, and what wrote that minuscule message will never trouble you or yours. But you must steel yourself to melancholy, and prepare your wife to do the same. I must tell you frankly that Charles's escape will not mean his restoration to you. He has been afflicted with a peculiar disease, as you must realize from the subtle physical as well as mental changes in him, and you must not hope to see him again. Have only this consolation, that he was never a fiend, or even truly a madman, but only an eager, studious, and curious boy whose love of mystery and of the past was his undoing. He stumbled on things no mortal ought ever to know, and reached back through the years as no one ever should reach, and something came out of those years to engulf him. And now comes the matter in which I must ask you to trust me most of all, for there will be indeed no uncertainty about Charles's fate. In about a year, say, you can, if you wish, devise a suitable account of the end, for the boy will be no more. You can put up a stone in your lot at the North Burial Ground, exactly 10 feet west of your father's, and facing the same way, and that will mark the true resting place of your son. Nor need you fear that it will mark any abnormality or changeling. The ashes in that grave will be those of your own unaltered bone and sinew, of the real Charles Dexter Ward, whose mind you watched from infancy. The real Charles with the olive mark on his hip, and without the black witch mark upon his chest, or the pit on his forehead. The Charles who never did actual evil, and who will have paid with his life for his squeamishness. That is all. Charles will have escaped, and a year from now you can put up his stone. Do not question me tomorrow, and believe that the honour of your ancient family remains untainted now, as it has been at all times in the past. With profoundest sympathy and exhortations to fortitude, calmness, and resignation, I am ever sincerely your friend, Marinus B. Willett. So on the morning of Friday, April 13th, 1928, Marinus Bicknell Willett visited the room of Charles Dexter Ward at Dr. Waite's private hospital on Connecticut Island. The youth, though making no attempt to evade his caller, was in a sullen mood, and seemed disinclined to open the conversation which Willett obviously desired. The doctor's discovery of the crypt and his monstrous experience therein had of course created a new source of embarrassment, so that both hesitated perceptibly after the interchange of a few strained formalities. Then a new element of constraint crept in, as Ward seemed to read behind the doctor's mask-like face a terrible purpose which had never been there before. The patient quailed, conscious that since the last visit there had been a change whereby the solicitor's family physician had given place to the ruthless and implacable avenger. Ward naturally turned pale, and the doctor was the first to speak. "More," he said, "has been found out, and I must warn you fairly that a reckoning is due." "Digging again and coming upon some poor starving pets?" was the ironic reply. It was evident that the youth meant to show bravado to the last. "No," Willett slowly rejoined. "This time I did not have to dig. We have had men looking up Dr. Allen, and they found the false beard and spectacles in the bungalow." "Excellent," commented the disquieted host in an effort to be wittingly insultingly. "And I trust they proved more becoming than the beard and glasses you now have on?" "They would become you very well," came the even and studied response, "as indeed they seem to have done." As Willett said this, it almost seemed as though a cloud passed over the sun, though there was no change in the shadows on the floor. Then Ward ventured, "And is this what asks you so hotly for a reckoning? Suppose a man does find it useful now and then to be twofold?" "No," said Willett gravely. "Again you were wrong. It is no business of mine if any man seeks duality, provided he has any right to exist at all, and provided he does not destroy what called him out of space." Ward now started violently. "Well, sir, what have ye found, and what do ye want of me?" The doctor let a little time elapse before replying, as if choosing his words for an effective answer. "I have found," he finally intoned, "something in a cupboard behind an ancient overmantel where a picture once was, and I have burned it, and burned the ashes where the grave of Charles Dexter Ward ought to be." The madman choked and sprang from the chair in which he had been sitting. "Damn ye! Who did ye tell? And who'll believe it if it was he after these 2 full months with me alive? What do you mean to do?" Willett, though a small man, actually took on a kind of judicial majesty as he calmed the patient with a gesture. I have told no one. This is no common case. It is a madness out of time, and a horror from beyond the spheres which no police or lawyers or courts or alienists could ever fathom or grapple with. Thank God some chance has left inside me a spark of imagination, that I might not go astray in thinking out this thing. You cannot deceive me, Joseph Kirwan, for I know that your accursed magic is true. I know how you wove the spell that brooded outside the years and fastened onto your double and descendant. I know how you drew him into the past and got him to raise you up from your detestable grave. I know how he kept you hidden in his laboratory while you studied modern things and roved abroad as a vampire by night, and how you later showed him yourself in beard and glasses that no one might wonder at your godless likeness to him. I know what you resolved to do when he balked at your monstrous rifling of the world's tombs and what you planned afterward, and I know how you did it. You left off your beard and glasses and fooled the guards around the house. They thought it was he who went in, and they thought it was he who came out when you had strangled and hidden him. But you hadn't reckoned on the different contents of two minds. You were a fool, Joseph Kirwan, to fancy that a mere visual identity would be enough. Why didn't you think of the speech, and of the voice, and of the handwriting? It hasn't worked, you see, after all. You know better than I who or what wrote that message in minuscules. But I will warn you, it was not written in vain. There are abominations and blasphemies which must be stamped out, and I believe that the writer of those words will attend to Orne and Hutchinson. One of those creatures wrote you once, "Do not call up any that you cannot put down." You were undone once before, perhaps in that very way, and it may be that your own evil magic will undo you all again. Kirwan, a man can't tamper with nature beyond certain limits, and every horror you have woven will rise up to wipe you out. But here the doctor was cut short by a convulsive cry from the creature before him. Hopelessly at bay, weaponless, and knowing that any show of physical violence would bring a score of attendants to the doctor's rescue, Joseph Kirwan had recourse to one of his ancient allies, and began a series of cabalistic motions with his forefingers as his deep, hollow voice, now unconcealed by feigned hoarseness, bellowed out the opening words of a terrible formula. Per Adonai, Elohim, Adonai Jehovah, Adonai Sabaoth, Metrathon. But Willett was too quick for him. Even as the dogs in the yard outside began to howl, and even as a chill wind sprang suddenly up from the bay, the doctor commenced the solemn and measured intonation of that which he had meant all along to recite. An eye for an eye, magic for magic. Let the outcome show how well the lessons of the abyss had been learned. So in a clear voice, Marinus Bicknell Willett began the second of that pair of formulae whose first had raised the writer of those minuscules, the cryptic invocation whose heading was the dragon's tail, sign of the descending node.
Ogra Dieth, Geblieth, Yog-Sothoth, Nungaya Nungayi, Zathra!
At the very first word from Willett's mouth, the previously commenced formula of the patient stopped short. Unable to speak, the monster made wild motions with his arms until they too were arrested. When the awful name of Yog-Sothoth was uttered, the hideous change began. It was not merely a dissolution, but rather a transformation or recapitulation, and Willett shut his eyes lest he faint before the rest of the incantation could be pronounced. But he did not faint, and that man of unholy centuries and forbidden secrets never troubled the world again. The madness out of time had subsided, and the case of Charles Dexter Ward was closed. Opening his eyes before staggering out of that room of horror, Dr. Willett saw that what he had kept in memory had not been kept amiss. There had, as he had predicted, been no need for acids, for like his accursed picture a year before, Joseph Kirwan now lay scattered on the floor as a thin coating of fine, bluish-grey dust. That's all for today, except to remind you that the opening music is by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. Until next time.
cthulhupodcast.co.uk.